Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Declared martial law.
Daddy, what's martial law?
The chocolate bars and the candy.
What a poem, Kirk.
Sir, there's a ship heading right for us.
You can't even guarantee the safety of your own crew.
To get ourselves a treat.
Now, shall we begin?
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Hi, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Carianis.
And welcome to this Angry History Podcast Extra. Not a full history show, a little something different.
Yes, it will come as no surprise to our wives and friends that history is not the only thing that gets us worked up. And since we've talked a lot about various things that we talk about at McSorley's, such as sci-fi and movies and the TV business and other things, we decided to do a podcast on a couple of movies that are out on DVD this week.
Yeah, and not just any movies. These are movies that hit close to our nerd marrow. And I'm a big believer. I think that, you know, people who love history tend to love science fiction. I'm not sure why. I think if someone did a study, I don't know, I think it would come out in our favor. But this is Star Trek, Into Darkness we're talking about here. And we'll get to World War Z shortly, the source material of which feels like history.
Yeah.
This is an Angry History System notification. All terrestrial stations and digital systems shall transmit this Angry History Action notification message. This program contains spoilers from two recent movies. If you proceed, you will not be effectively shielded from major plot points. The Angry History Alert System has been activated.
So we decided we would jump in. Start with Star Trek Into Darkness. Now, the Star Trek franchise, as you were just saying, that's already history. Our first space shuttle was named Enterprise.
Yep.
We posted a few days ago, actually, on Facebook.com/angryhistory, President Ford signing off on naming it.
I always love that. Even now, looking back at that day when they dedicated it, everyone but Shatner was there. I'm not sure where he was, sleeping in the back of his car someplace. But
he's a rocket, man.
He's a rocket, man. He packed his bags last night.
Yeah.
Pre-flight. Star Trek Into Darkness. This is J.J. Abrams' second time directing a Star Trek film. The first one was the 2009 reboot, a movie that we both loved. I still remember sitting there the first time, you know, that 12-minute opening where everything changes and the timeline slips, and then all of a sudden, you know, we smash into this big giant stone command insignia and this great triumphant music, and I was like, wow, someone cares about Star Trek again. It was so exciting. And now we have this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the fact that it does come from history, the name, it's an epic name. Yeah. Gene Roddenberry named it after the ship in World War II, the aircraft carrier. The Japanese kept counting it out and thinking that they'd sunk it. They reported they sank it three times. It was the most storied ship, 20 battle stars.
Not to be confused with battle stars.
Yeah.
For our other science fiction fans. We're talking about battle stars, not battle stars.
Yeah.
So, sorry.
Right.
I'm a jerk.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the kind of thing that would make you angry if you heard somebody saying, so I could live with it. So the Big E, this was a storied ship.
Because the Japanese thought they sunk it, you know, three times, they called it the Grey Ghost because it just sort of kept coming back. You know, you don't mess with the Enterprise.
No.
Apparently you can mess with this Enterprise, though.
Yeah. you could put it underwater.
You can put it underwater.
Where was the big Spock lecture on the Prime Directive when they were deciding to drop him into a volcano when they were just there to survey the planet?
Right.
And there's a lot of these things that have already been mentioned, so we won't rehash all of them.
Right.
It's been voted the worst film by Trekkies, which is really something, because apparently there's some film called Star Trek V out there that I'd never heard of.
You just going to sit there and pluck that thing, or are you going to play something?
I've never. You keep saying this. I always thought it was strange that it went from 4 to 6. And I was like, well, shouldn't you just go to 5? But apparently, yeah, they just decided to do that for some reason. You know, some buildings skip the 13th floor, you know, for superstition's
sake.
It's
like Pope John's in the 13th century. They just skip 20. There's no Pope Double X, which you would think would have been a cool name. But no, it just skips right over.
Especially for a plus-size Pope, you know?
Yeah. Pope and a pizza.
Tell them, Jim! Tell them, Jim! Tell them, Jim!
Never was a game.
I stop for a second because I can hear the neighbor's kids, and I guess because they know we're doing Star Trek, they're just outside screaming, grup, 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 grup. So,
bonk, bonk.
Bonk, bonk on the head. Where were we?
Well, kids could not even possibly have really liked this movie if they'd grown up as they should have, learning their basic Star Trek.
Right.
In fact, I had a director once, one TV show that I worked for, and he said to me, you know how many years the American Civil War was? And he asked the associate director that was next to him, and he didn't. And he said, well, if you knew your Star Trek, you would know what Abraham Lincoln said. Can I just hug you?
Yeah, like, you're a nice man. You don't scare me like other TV people.
Not that you hadn't studied in school, but the fact that you hadn't learned it on Star Trek.
Right. And we talk about Star Trek and the place that it holds for us, those bright primary colors of the uniforms, everything. Those are some of my earliest memories, you know, watching it in syndication on WPIX when we were kids. And I have a son now who's three, and you know, I'm trying to think, you know, this is all he needs. This is all he needs to watch, to learn about what life should be. But and I'm a firm believer in that. Not this film, though.
Yeah, it was just kind of sad. I would not run out and get it. One thing that bugged me at somebody having a science degree, cold fusion doesn't work that way. You don't drop it into, and a lot of these things have been said already, so we're not going to go rehash all those.
You know, you do something so sort of goofy, yet you put the thing underwater. You're not supposed to infect the indigenous culture, but you put a gigantic UFO in the water. And it prevents you from doing your job correctly because you got to, you know, get over you have a line of sight or something with the Enterprise to get Spock out. But don't frighten these people with this gigantic metal beast coming out of the water. It just didn't make any sense. I was like, this is how we're getting this thing off and running. I was surprised.
Yeah. Even the mention of salt water bugged me. At least make it a different kind of water. Right. You know, they used to do those little things in there, you know?
Right. Make it a class L planet, you know, where you have some other, you know, differences in composition of things there. Don't make it class M, you know? I don't know. It's just...
Yeah.
I just wanted to say something before we get too much further. You know, we don't want this to be a rag fest against Into Darkness, but... You go back 4 years ago when the first Abrams reboot came out, and first of all, it was just so exciting. It was to go in knowing that someone who did some really cool sci-fi stuff was handed the reins to our favorite franchise. And that opening sequence, you know, where Nero comes through and we see in grand fashion, you know, what can happen when a timeline gets messed with, something that we'd seen all the time in the show. And then that 12-minute awesome intro, Kirk's dad dies, you know, everyone's wet-eyed before the movie even starts. And it's like, wow, Star Trek is back and someone cares about it. And it's awesome. It's bigger than it's ever been in terms of on-screen scope. And that carried through for the most part with that first film. Gosh, we loved it. I loved it. When my dad came out here to visit in the spring, we were both sat on the couch watching it and, you know, kind of happy tears pouring down our face for all the love that was clearly put into this film. And then this movie came out and at least as far as I'm concerned, all that goodwill vanished.
Yeah, they didn't quite catch lightning in a bottle the second time here, or phase plasma in a bottle. And I think the fact is they tried, and this happens a lot, I think, with things that we've seen produced. They had success, and then they decided, well, now we want to say something. We want it to be more than just sci-fi. But Star Trek, and even the first Star Trek, it's never just sci-fi. There's always something that's happening, and a lot of the ones that are dealing with issues in the 60s that you'll see, those are dealing with very real things. They're not
right.
Primarily about science fiction. Even the eugenics wars. I mean, we weren't so far removed from eugenics when they wrote this episode about a Superman who'd been genetically engineered to be superior to everybody.
Yeah.
William Shatner, the legendary William Shatner, said, when you get into the small screen, you need stories. Entertaining, interesting, vital stories that have a philosophy and also have an excitement about them. So the viewer stays with it, but receives the philosophy as a byproduct. Those are the best of Star Trek, those kinds of stories. And that kind of thing, there's always room for that. That kind of imaginative approach that stirs young people into wanting to be connected with science.
Right, right. Absolutely. You know, and again, I hate to sound like one of these sort of fanboys who are like, you know, it has to be exactly this way, the way it was. I don't want that at all. Not at all. But there was just some things that felt so forced, especially when you're starting to deal with a Khan story, which was a shame that they went there so soon, you know. in the second movie. They could have, but they had to deal with it at all. I wish it would have been further down the road.
It just has to be a good story. I mean, that's all we ever asked of Star Trek. I mean, right. The ones that are the message ones are some of the best ones, but this really felt shoehorned in, mm-hmm. and our emotions felt very played on. Like, we have the trailer here for the original Wrath of Khan, since this is more or less not even a remake. It's like a pale mirror of a lot of things.
I'm not sure what it is. It's go ahead. Sorry. It's just bugging me.
Happy birthday. Truly the best of times.
What am I feeling? Old.
Other people have birthdays. Why are we treating yours like a funeral?
Worn out.
I'm your doctor, and I'm your friend. Get back your command. Before you really do grow old.
Commanding a starship is your first best destiny.
There's a man up there I haven't seen in 15 years. He's trying to kill me.
I'll chase him round the moons of Nibia and round the Antares maelstrom and round perdition's flames before I give him up.
An emergency situation has arisen. I'm assuming command of this vessel.
Fire! Hang on!
Remember that overgrown Boy Scout you used to hang around with?
Jim Kirk was many things, but he was never a Boy Scout.
Fire.
Spock!
I remember being so excited in 1982 when this came out, and my brother Thomas and I went to go see it with friends of ours, the Velasquez brothers. And just the night before, PIX showed Space Seed. And so I remember watch Space Seed, and the next day I went to see this insane movie, and it was great. And, you know, it was, you know, obviously it was in our household because of things like the 4 o'clock movie. Montalban was more than just Mr. Rourke. He was, you know, from Planet of the Apes. He was, you know, and he was obviously Khan. So it was exciting. That movie just keeps getting better and better and better, and it plays so well in so many ways because, goodness, we have an invested relationship with these characters already. And it's a problem for the filmmakers. I'm not quite sure how else they would have handled it. Maybe they could have avoided doing a Khan movie. It would be one way. But we don't have the depth. We don't have the time. The relationships don't have the legwork that they did in original Trek. Not just because, you know, Chris Pine is new and Zach Quinto and the other people. And they're terrific, I think. You know, I think Pine is great. But I didn't find myself getting goosebumpy or engaged when they did what they did with this film at the end, all this sort of mirror stuff. It just didn't, it just felt all too shoehorned and tacked on.
And 82 was not, it's not just because we were young, I want to add, because I could hear people yelling at their earbuds that, you know, you were young then, you liked, but that wasn't the case.
And you know what? We're not going to insert a thought that you think we might hear. I'll just do it myself. I feel young. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, but you want.
Is it wrong that I'm getting more aggravated with this than about any other thing we've covered in Angry History? It really sticks in my craw.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, these are good actors. It's not like they're bad people, but it's just you got to know what you want to say. It's not enough just to tell people like a New Yorker cartoon, hey, no, there's a meaning here. Don't ask any questions.
Right.
It seemed like a six-month-old Newsweek magazine, if you think of how dated a six-month-old Newsweek was. It's like, oh, okay, you're going on drones. And I said to my wife, Kathy, she's Canadian. She wasn't at all thinking about that. And she thought, well, it's fine not knowing any of the things. But is that why? I mean, why would he put him in torpedo tube? That seems like an unsafe place. Like, what would he? It was just there were just so many things that you just felt like they were doing things other than servicing the characters and the story.
Right.
And there was nothing risked. There was nothing lost. Everything was just, oh, well, hey, these people are in tubes. So you could see this guy's point. Except that we know they're not good people.
Right.
And we have that confirmed at the end by, you know, the things that Khan is doing, or this man calling himself Khan. But if you are familiar with the old story, you know these are 80 Napoleons, as Spock calls them.
That's right.
So, you know, you're not so sad to see them killed, maybe. If you're right. On some level, even if you consider yourself the biggest pacifist in the world, you're saying, well, you know, oh, well, they're frozen fish sticks, eugenic sticks. They'll never know what hit them anyway, and who cares?
That's right. flying on the SS Margaret Sanger. You make a good point, a couple of things, and I want to talk about Khan himself directly in a second, but about this notion of aiding Napoleons. And there's a great discussion that Kirk and Spock and McCoy have in Space Seed. And it's one of these things where you want to talk about what makes that triumvirate so great. Go look at the episode. And Scotty's in that scene, too, I think. And you go hear Spock's confusion when they're essentially complimenting Khan and saying that he was not the worst of the tyrants. But it's a very cool bit of character shading that seems to be utterly lacking here. You know, it's like they were trying to play catch up. They had to hit some predetermined points to try to make us feel character moments.
And it was another vengeance movie, which, you know, in a way, Ricardo Montalban was so great. There's some interview with him, actually, that we'll link to, him talking about this character, how it was closest that he came as a Mexican-American actor to the great role that he would have loved to have played. It really casts such a long shadow over all the later movies, where in the first one, they were still sort of looking, and it was space, and it was the unknown. And also in the fourth one, it was kind of like that. But now there always had to be the big villain, and they decided to bring him in there in such a way. I mean, really, he's a high-tech weapons genius.
Yeah.
Yes, he had a superior intellect, but, you know, if you wanted to do it, why couldn't you just go back, get the old eugenic stuff and boost it up? Even though if you're going to break the law,
right?
I mean, you couldn't bring Alexander the Great back, or, you know, any of the great leaders in history and say, oh, well, here, sit down at this computer. And I mean, no matter how fast he learned, Khan, he still needed the Enterprise crew to run the ship. There's that great scene in Wrath of Khan where Kirk pulls that little move and drops their shields, and they pan the camera back and forth across the controls.
That's great.
And they don't know which switch it is to put the shields back up.
Right. Joaquin doesn't know what to do.
Who was uncredited in that role, which he kicked,
that was so strange.
Kicked himself.
But he had a show that was on Friday nights on for a couple of years called Phoenix. Anyone else remember that?
Oh, yeah.
But I know you do. But
oh, sorry. I thought I was the Greek chorus.
You are the Greek. let's talk about the casting for a moment, because it seems to be the biggest thing. I remember in the lead up to this, and I love to be surprised, and I stay away from spoilers depending on my mood for certain things. Benedict Cumberbatch, who I think is great, you know, he's awesome in Sherlock. He's Khan. He's not supposed to be John Harrison. He's not supposed to be one of the other cryo dudes. He's supposed to be Khan Noonien Singh, and he sure don't look like him. Sure don't sound like him.
Yeah.
And this, okay, so I don't want to call it a whitewash, what you want to call it, but you have a quote from, who was it, Orsi, talking about the casting decision. Quote, "It became uncomfortable for me to support demonizing anyone of color, particularly anyone of Middle Eastern descent or anyone evoking that. One of the points of the movie is that we must be careful about the villain within us, not some other race," end quote. It's Khan. It's Khan.
Yeah, I never thought of Khan as having any, I mean, that's why Montalban actually chose that sort of generic accent.
Right.
It's great. I guess we've come to the point where we can have a British accent for the millionth time spoke by Satan. You know, we finally evolved to the point where a white actor can play a Mexican actor playing an Indian guy. But it's just,
was that Charlton Heston in, in Touch of Evil?
Oh, that mustache was great.
It was.
You know, if you draw a mustache on a $5 bill, it looks exactly like Charlton Heston in Touch of Evil.
That's awesome.
That's true. But they were originally, though, they wanted, I'm sorry.
No. You really, Del Toro, right?
Right.
Yeah. He's a Latino actor. And I don't know. It sounds like he was just sort of backing himself into a corner for no good reason.
And if you were going to do it, it's fine. Give us some explanation. I mean, somebody asked, is Khan cosmetically altered to avoid detection? And he said, one of his abilities is a shapeshifter.
I mean, that was a joke, obviously. A bad
Yeah, one. I mean, he says, oh, that's an interesting idea, could be. And Owen and I both heard a Creative Screenwriter Magazine podcast, a Q&A that they did. And those guys answered every question from every nerd out there about what they thought and the possibility of this or that or this plot hole. And they had answers for everyone because they'd gone through that script and they thought about it. And this time, I'm sorry to say, they got lazy. They got lazy about it, you know, and they did it very paint by numbers. And it's fine if it still turns out to be a good movie. I mean, the next movie that we're going to talk about was not like the book at all. And that's okay because they produced a good movie.
I do have also, you know, there are things out here. I live in Los Angeles and you always hear, and you hear it sort of in the popular realm too, about studio pressure and suits putting their hands in things and messing them up and blah, blah, blah. And I don't know the entire backstory about what happened with the production of this film, except that it just didn't turn out right. And it doesn't feel like Star Trek. And you know what? To put the TIE fighter noise on that Klingon ship, that was with dirty pool. Abrams can take can leave Star Trek behind if he wants and do whatever he wants with Star Wars. Knock yourself out. I have an idea for the third movie, though.
You do? Well, lay it on me. This is an exclusive.
I want the third movie to have like a shadowy figure who is like trying to hunt down Spock Prime. He's hunting for him. And Lil Kirk and Lil Spock assume that this guy is... He's like styled as a merc or a rogue leader of a small hunt team, and they just think this guy is a threat. You know why? Because he is a threat. He's a threat to the very existence of their universe. And turns out this man is it's Kirk Prime. He's alive. And he's saying a big fat F you to your 24th century temporal rules by ripping open space-time one last time to rescue his best friend. And now the idea how Shatner could get there is easy. You pull up any time travel device, he goes back to the Guardian Forever. Oh, but wait, he's in the Nexus? I guess, if you have to say he's in the Nexus. He wakes up and says, oh yeah, this is dumb. And then he pulls himself out of the Nexus, so he's not in there anymore. And he finds out that his boy is gone, and he comes back and hunts him down. And at the end, Kirk Prime and Spock Prime leave, and this terrible universe collapses onto itself and never exists. The end.
Now, you got to tell me one thing. What was it you referred to the cast of these new movies as?
in a moment of not feeling generous, Muppet Baby. I'm sure it's been applied to every reboot concept, but
well, you know, it really fits because it's a beloved franchise that you sort of see change. And again, these guys, I mean, you've had interaction with a couple of them, they're not bad, but it's the material and it's the fact that it can't just be the studio when you have the writer and the director defending it, blaming the video game, and sort of giving a rough time to people who are raising legitimate story writing questions. You know, there's a line in Aerosmith and Dream On, live and learn from fools and from sages. These are not people who are just writing stupid internet comments about dumb things.
Right.
And if people have legitimate points, they know if they leave unsatisfied. And the first rule as a writer is you don't get to go to the reader and say, no, you didn't understand what I was saying. It's up to you to make yourself understood and seen. And that's why this movie just didn't do as well as the first one, and I don't think the DVDs will do as well.
One of the things, too, is that, you know, if you look back at the original series, and it was a naval command structure, but there was a command structure, and there was respect for rank and position in the show. And we're 5 minutes into this movie, and, you know, Uhura and Spock are having a spat.
Yeah.
Their captain, Captain Kirk, says, all right, guys, you know, cool it. You know, we're on a mission. And she's like, just a minute, Captain. It's like, what? Not just a minute, yeah. Not just a minute, cutie pie, funny face, lovey-dovey Spock and Uhura. Just stop talking. Your captain told you to stop talking. Stop talking.
Yeah, and it just, you know, comic relief is one thing, which there was tons of, obviously, in the original series.
Listen, Star Trek has its share of awful comic relief.
Yeah, yeah.
That I saw a trailer for a movie that never existed, that I never saw, where Scotty says, I know this ship like the back of my hand, and he turns and he smacks his head on a bulkhead. But so, yeah, Star Trek is no stranger to lame jokes.
Right, but you can't suck out the drama of the situation. I mean, they're supposedly behind enemy lines here to pick up a mass murderer. Who would do that? It's the idiot in the attic, they call it, in writing a novel or a movie. You know, when you say don't go in there and the person knows there's monsters around or vampires and that person still goes in the attic alone without a gun,
right,
you lose sympathy for them. You just, oh, well, okay, fine, get killed.
Right.
Down the centuries, you have slurred the meaning out of the words, we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty. To ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution, these words and the words that follow were not written only for the Yangs, but for the Korms as well.
The Korms.
They must apply to everyone, or they mean nothing. Do you understand?
I just was having a discussion with a buddy of mine, Andrew, last night. He's from Dublin. He grew up in Chicago, and he's not a huge fan of Star Trek. But he always remembers how, especially when he was 11, when he moved here, and new kid, new country, the Omega Glory not only made him have a special feeling for Kirk and Star Trek, but it helped him fall in love with his adopted country. So if you know the episode and you know the scene, this e plebnista, three words, larger than the rest, you know, written with a power and passion, Never heard before or since. So we watched that scene last night out in the yard over a drink. And gosh, it is great. And that's sort of what the great takeaway for me about Star Trek is. It's, you know, people can mock the sets and people can, you know, mock Shatner's acting, which I think is ridiculous. You watch him in season one especially, and he's fantastic. but Star Trek was sort of a bellwether for how we were doing as a country. And this movie took those ideas of that, you know, oh, it needs to be a message. And like you said, just sort of rammed it down our throats. And I wasn't happy. Hopefully the third one will be great. In the meantime, I'm content to treat it like The Matrix. You know, we had that first one from 2009, which is terrific, and I'll just forget the rest. So,
well, the final word, as you're saying, that has to go to our friend Mojo, who said he was sitting there watching it, not liking what he was seeing on the screen. And then he said, look, brain, this isn't your Star Trek. They can't hurt your Star Trek. Now shut up so I can go back to killing you with IPAs.
Yep. All right, and I gotta go punch the wall. Two-handed to the side like Kirk.
So let's take a news break, why don't we? And then we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about World War Z.
It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder. A widespread investigation of reports from funeral homes, morgues, and hospitals has concluded that the unburied dead are coming back to life and seeking human victims.
Ah, this is one of my actual favorite parts from the original Night of the Living Dead. And I love this in movies when you get media that deals with whatever the situation is. And this is playing on a radio. There's a sort of a zombie purity. And for me, that's the Romero zombie. That is the slow-moving zombie that is not going to chase you down the street, but is going to break you down mentally and spiritually because it's just a slow, oppressive dread. That, to me, actually becomes a wonderful place for stories because you're able to have quiet moments within this as you're holed up or as you're, you know, doing whatever. And I think what's not in this clip is, isn't there an earlier point where they talk about some probe returned from orbit?
Yeah, that was a big deal, actually, for him because he said he never wanted to say what exactly had happened, but it got edited some certain ways.
Right.
And he didn't get to leave the mystery of why this had happened. And so he says you read it all the time now, especially since he lost the right. He let his rights to this lapse, and that's why it's in public domain.
Yeah, it's crazy. Guys, go look. Yeah. Go. There are a lot of strange versions of Night of the Living Dead out there because of that very reason. Very, very odd.
Now, this is not Max Brooks' book, though, this movie.
No, World War Z. Max Brooks, World War Z. A little quick background. Max Brooks, who's the son of Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft, He released an awesome book called The Zombie Survival Guide, and it was designed like the Anarchist Cookbook, which is a sort of this basement, guerrilla survivalist guide to getting things done. And after that book came out, and I was actually buying this book for everyone for like a really long time because I think it's insanely entertaining and it makes some good points about protecting yourself from the zombie menace. And I think really that's what life boils down to. After that, he released World War Z, and I was looking at the notes, and I didn't realize he based this on The Good War, which is one of my favorite books, where it's Studs Terkel's oral history of World War II, and he interviews a bunch of veterans, mostly in the early 80s, so these guys were still, you know, pretty spry. So he built this book, World War Z, which is a post-facto account of the Great Zombie War, and he sends his character around to sort of piece together what had happened. And we get these terrific retellings of some of the major events of the zombie war. This movie is not that. It's good. It's fun. Don't call them zombies. You know, I've got a weird, listen, the part of my brain that enjoys and reveres these pop culture things. I mean, this is not an obsession for me in life. You know, I mean, we're indulging it now because this is our fun place to indulge it. They went Fast Zombie, which produces a different film and a different viewing experience altogether. And it pretty much in toto tossed out his whole sort of travelogue approach.
Yeah, he used this book. I think these really, I didn't realize how well these two movies were going to add commentary to each other or reflect on each other. But, you know, Max Brooks used his book to comment about contemporary events, I guess you'd say. And that was what Star Trek always did the best. And I felt like they just missed that mark by a mile in the Star Trek Into Darkness. Like, they just really missed it. They didn't talk about any of that. And, you know, they don't talk about a lot of social commentary in the World War Z movie. But it's still worth seeing because they cared about telling a story, even though really the only thing it shares with the movie and the book is the title.
Yeah, we never got the Battle of Yonkers, which is such an awesome, unhinged and great, great battle. I mean, he really did such a terrific job, Brooks, with this. But again, I'm not here to crap on World War Z because I was surprised how much I enjoyed it. You know, I thought Pitt was really good in it, and the whole family setup again. Divorce yourself from the source material and you may have some fun.
Yeah, go see both. I think one of the things we also try to do with the Angry History is say things aren't binary to us. Like a lot of people, well, who's your favorite president? Who's your best? There are different things about different things. These just happen to be two things that share the same name, but they're not similar at all. They're not really even from the same source material, which is so odd. I mean, you, like you were saying, live out there, swim out there in Hollywood. Why go into a bidding war for these book rights and then not base it on the book at all? It just seems so strange to do that. And in fact, throw out one whole script.
Yeah, your J. Michael Straczynski script. And you and Mojo love him from Babylon 5, which is amazingly a show that I've not climbed on board to yet. I'll get there. He wrote like years ago when things were starting to build with this movie, the idea that this movie might actually happen, you know. And people said, oh my gosh, he wrote this script and it's going to be like the David Lean zombie movie, you know, epic and whatever. And on the page, that's what you think World War Z would be. I think World War Z would have benefited from, like a 13-hour HBO thing like Band of Brothers, you know. Then you could have had time to explore, get some cool nuance. That all being said, there are some insane action sequences in this movie. And we were talking about Jerusalem last night a little bit and how nuts that was.
Yeah. I mean, it inspired some great stuff. It's okay. I mean, the Shining, the book and the movie, much more similar than this. But still, I mean, it inspired Kubrick to go and make what he wanted to make and make a movie. So that's okay.
Right. The key difference between the Shining and the movie and book is that you can get hit more than once with a mallet.
Yeah.
You really can't get hit more than once with an axe.
Well, like Tom Clancy said, they asked them if it ever bother him that what they do with the movie from his book, and he said no, they can't touch the book, like we were saying Mojo says, you know.
Right,
he said
once
I take that sack of money, I can't really complain either, you know. And I right. I don't think that Max Brooks is complaining. I mean, he said he would tell people if he thought it wasn't the same, but there are some great things that we would like someday to see, whether it's Krasinski's script or somebody else's. I mean, the evacuation of the Japanese home islands, the choice in South Africa to set up zones of survivors to basically be bait for the undead while these survivors behind their walls prep their defenses. 11 million dying of starvation and freezing in northern Canada that have fled away from the zombies. The International Space Station looking down and seeing a swarm of zombies in the Great Plains. I mean, these would all be great things to someday see.
That was such a great, I remember that so well. And remember a couple of days ago, I sent you a piece, a buddy of mine, Bill, sent me that piece about the only American who was off planet during 9/11 and how he looked down and saw the scar in Lower Manhattan from space. And it's interesting to, you put it over there with the zombie thing. Obviously, and this is, guys, not to compare 9/11 to a fictional zombie apocalypse, but what makes Brooks's book so great is that it's about the details.
Yeah, and you can comment on it in a way. I mean, again, Star Trek, the original series, they talked about nuclear war and ways that didn't mock it or make it silly. And you can look sometimes at fiction. Usually they say fiction sells much better in hard economic times. People want something they can look at it sort of like, Perseus's shield. You don't want to look right at Medusa, but you'll look at a reflection of her. And that was that kind of thing. And if you want a less dramatic example, although not for this guy, was the Russian who was up in Mir. He went up as a Soviet cosmonaut and he came down and the Soviet Union had fallen apart. Because, I always think of him just sitting up there saying, am I going to have a country to go back to? And it turns out he didn't, really.
And this notion of something gaining a reputation for being a message property, that's George Romero right there. I mean, the first film was certainly allegorical to what was happening in the late 60s. And then he made this great statement about, the moral imperative of acquisitiveness in the late 70s with Dawn of the Dead. And then he began to believe his own press. And so everything had to be ham-handed. If you look at those later zombie films, which are just sort of disappointing to me, because it's like he's forcing message all over the place and he's being so explicit about it, too. It's like, too bad.
Well, Max Brooks said he thinks that Easy Rider and Dawn of the Dead should be sold as a box set because they're two ends of the baby boomers.
Wow.
They start out with all these great high ideals and then it just sort of died off and they end up huddled in a mall, the home of commercialism or the storage house of commercialism. And so he said, they all cults kind of sold out there. But it is hard to produce consistently good stuff. And I think maybe one positive thing for the studio system, or talking about the negatives, is, you know, every Planet of the Apes movie, Fox cut the budget.
That's right. That's right. Each time out. Yep.
And so they forced them to do things. And Star Trek, too. You know, they got some lousy shows there out of it because they couldn't build sets and a lot of sci-fi. But, you know, you need more than just lens flares and CGI to make a movie.
Excuse me. Hold on. Lady Eden. Excuse me.
Well, speaking of the baby boomers, I'm sure that at the time when they were really baked and watching that, it was probably pretty awesome. I never got that guy's ears, though.
I know.
Don't be a Herbert, okay?
You don't be a Herbert. That episode was just bad, top to bottom.
I like when he died in the end, though. That was worth it.
You just kept pretending he was Wilson.
I didn't eat pears for 2 months.
What was it? Snap, crack my knuckles and jump for joy. I got a clean bill of health from Dr. McCoy. Stop talking. Just shut your dirty space mouth.
But there was great commentary in the book. The movie is just a fun movie. If I was going to lay down my Quatluz or Latinum, I think I would go. I would lay it down definitely on World War Z before Into Darkness, because, you know, it was just a fun romp. And also pick up that book, read about some of these things and sort of can reflect on it. He wanted to reflect on, you know, isolationist feeling in the U.S., and not in any grand political scheme, just in general, like anybody else. I mean, we have so much here. We're the focus. You look at a map of what news stories cover. I mean, something that happens in New York is going to get covered. Something that happens like in Colorado right now with all these people flooded, there's just not that attention given to it. People are homers, you know. They follow what's right in their backyard. And, you know, you don't have to get a satellite truck.
Nope.
It's not easy to book one of those, and they're not cheap, and you got to justify it. So you might as well just shoot what's out your window, especially now, all this internet stuff.
Absolutely. And a really cool thing, too, if you want to sort of open up the World War Z experience in something that is much closer to the source material, get the unabridged audiobook. It's awesome. It is so much fun to listen to. And it's word for word, and it becomes a sort of a very cool journey to take listening to this whole thing. And if you watch what Brooks does, too, the way he sets up his chapters, he's lightly tracking the spread of the virus. So it's pretty neat to sort of see all that come together that way.
One thing, speaking of the social commentary that Brooks makes in the novel, is they set up a Russian breeding program. And for me, as I said, having studied animal science, and I always get a little creeped out, whatever you want to call it, annoyed, dare I say angry, when I see people in the paper referred to as a female or a male, or I just think for people, we're people. We're men and women. We're not male and female.
Like, right.
Probably just me. But anyway, then this is why.
Like the lady huskies, you know? Like, why put that prefix in front of it?
No. Or they say breeding program. You know, like, this is literally what it is in this case. And Russia just celebrated its 8th annual Day of Conception / Procreation Day. It's September 12th. Vlad Putin tells them, don't go to work today, comrade. Stay home. A smear borscht, I guess, on yourself and go to town.
Right. And Chikawow. Yeah.
Chikowowski.
Tovarich. Oh, yeah. Hordes on the ocean floor. I forgot about that, too. That was another. There's so many great. I almost want to call them visuals because they just. I see the pictures in my head when I read Brooks's stuff. But yeah, hordes on the ocean floor. So cool. Again, we're never going to get the World War Z, you know, the 13-hour treatment. But considering all the negative energy going into hating on this movie before it came out, I was glad that it was, you know, watchable and fun.
Yeah, and if, we couldn't have hordes on the ocean floor, we could watch Into Darkness and see a starship on the ocean floor.
It's true. I have to, tonight, we're going out to dinner in a couple hours, and I just know tonight I'm going to have to watch some original Trek, and I may have to throw in Dawn of the Dead, the original. I'm feeling sci-fi-y, and I need to get the taste of Into Darkness out of my mouth. Yuck.
All right. Well, we'll have to just get to that then, I guess. And maybe I'll watch some too. I'm trying to think. Maybe I'll get a piece of the action myself.
Ooh, great idea. And hey, you know what? Just a couple of thoughts about other things to watch. I'm not sure. Zack Snyder, his remake of Dawn of the Dead. It's a fast zombie movie, but it's actually really cool. There's some really good stuff in there. And it holds on to some of the spirit of Romero. I like that one a lot. And any other good zombie movies? Well, Walking Dead is fun too.
Frost Nixon.
Yes, Frost Nixon. Well,
Frost just died, so I figured.
Yeah.
What are you doing, Frost? Walking so slowly. Right. Get in here.
You don't look good. Haldeman! Get me a burrito and get Frost out of here. Headshots only. So. I don't do a good Nixon.
Yeah. Well, that was supposed to be Nixon. Huh. I thought it was Agnew.
Yeah. Yes. I'm known internationally for my Spiro Agnew impersonation. It's pretty awesome. As we wrap this up, Dean and I were like, hey, yeah, you know what? This little extra, it's going to be, we're going to do 6.5 minutes on each movie and then we'll be done. It'll be nice. And obviously we're approaching the 3 hour mark. I have one thought that I want to leave about Max Brooks. And one of the things that I just love about what he does in the survival guide is the pencil drawing of illustrating why during a zombie apocalypse. I think this is only as high as a level. Level 1, you don't have to worry, but a level 2 is why you want to have short hair. Cut your hair immediately. And there's a great illustration. If we can find it, we'll put it on the site of a zombie hand reaching out, grabbing someone with long hair. That shows bad. And then there's a photo, a drawing next to it of someone with short hair and the zombie hand missing. That's good. And that's how you survive a zombie apocalypse. That and destroy your staircases.
Yeah, just don't knock your teeth out. That's a little extreme. And have a hatchet.
That was a little extreme.
Or the Lobo, the lobotomizer.
The Lobo.
You have one, don't you, Owen?
I do. I do have a Lobo. Bill got me that for my birthday a few years ago.
You've killed 7 old men with walkers there in L.A. I don't know why I keep telling you, Lee. It's just an old man. But, better safe
Dean,
than sorry.
Dean. Hmm? No, I didn't.
Oh.
No, I didn't.
We can edit that out in post.
Okay. Leave it in. All right. Hey, I'm getting heat stroke. September is the cruelest month out here, and my booth is very hot. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And that was fun, and we'll see you guys very soon for our upcoming Angry History show on the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.
See you then.
All right. Bye-bye.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at angryhistory, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.